Is it time for a podcast already?
Check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2, check 1 2.
I go to your seat, lady, cause this one's a screamer.
I didn't know that.
Welcome back, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Garlic Jar Podcast Show. Today, we have cooked up another special episode for you guys. This past month, it was close to being the anniversary of the Sharon Tate murder and everybody that was at her house the evening of August 8th, 1969. So we're coming at you with a special Manson episode tonight, Charles Manson, and we're going to focus on some details about him and some of the, you know, most known murders of his cult followers. So tonight with me, I have, as usual, Matt, and Sean is, you know, coming back with us tonight to revisit some of these topics with us. How's everybody doing?
Oh, definitely. I'm doing good. Doing good, Jen.
Great. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, good. Busy.
Yeah, school. It's a busy work week. So far, so good, though, I guess.
Yeah, it always is.
Yep.
Yeah, we're podcasting through Hurricane Ida tonight, guys.
Oh, that's such a good. That's a good drop. That's a good mention.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I mean, we were just talking about that. I think the rain's kind of dying up right now. Things seem to be getting a little bit better out there. I'll tell you what, though. Sleep with the windows open if it's not raining, because it's nice and cool.
Nice. Finally, it's about time. So, that's good.
Well, where do we go with tonight's journey? Because I know we're talking about Manson. I mean, this obviously would go into the whole fact of his... I always referred to it as a cult.
Yes.
You know, the Manson family. And, I mean, it's just kind of weird, because just even over the past couple weeks, watching documentaries... watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah, that was a requirement.
Right, I got that right?
Yeah, I made Matt watch that before the episode tonight.
And man, that was a good movie.
So I haven't seen it.
All right, so
I haven't seen that.
For those of you that don't know, it's actually Quentin Tarantino's last film, like his most recent film, I should say. And it focuses on partially what happened to Sharon Tate and her friends the night of the murders, and how the people broke into the house, and they show like pretty much everything. Like, that's just like one of the side plots, because if you've seen the Tarantino movie before, you know that there's like 20 different things going on. But yeah, that's one of the
typical
like, the side
typical
plots.
Yep.
Yeah, so it's definitely,
but overall was a really good movie.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing I thought was funny about that movie, man, did they I don't know if it was Quentin Tarantino's idea about putting that in, but, like, the way that they portrayed Bruce Lee. Like, I, for some reason, I just got a kick out of that. Like, I was laughing at that scene the whole entire time, because I'm thinking to myself, I think this would be the reversal, you know?
Yeah, and...
But it was a good movie. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, one of the main stars was Leonardo DiCaprio. He was actually nominated for Best Actor, of course, for this film. But, of course, he didn't win. He didn't win his Oscar until the following year with The Revenant. So,
The Revenant, yeah.
Yep.
That was a good movie, too.
He had to fight a bear to get an Oscar, poor guy. So
that's a good way of putting it, too.
So I think Sean has some breaking news for us that he wants to start off the evening with.
Yeah, before we get into Manson, I know you guys probably seen the news that Sirhan finally, you know, got his appeal approved, and now he's just waiting. So that was breaking news. And, of course, you know, like I said before, the creatures are out, you know, people making comments, and people that don't know anything about the case, and they got to say something. And it's just ridiculous, you know. I'm listening to some of these comments, and people are outraged and everything, and they don't look at any of the evidence. Like, if you look at the evidence, we talked about this in the RFK episode. Sirhan is sitting in jail for 50 years for something he didn't do. The evidence proves that. Thomas Noguchi's autopsy proved the shot came from the back. and it was point blank range. Sirhan was never that close to Bobby Kennedy. He was the closest he was 5 to 6 feet in front of Bobby. He was never in back of him.
Yeah.
And then the bullets that were pulled out, they were from a different gun. The serial number didn't match of the other victims. So Sirhan didn't shoot anybody. He was firing blanks that night. So, you know, people are just, you know, you listen to all these creatures on Facebook, and there's a particular idiot that's making comments, and he's bashing Bobby Kennedy's son for coming out in defense of Sirhan. And then he's, you know, the sheep that follow him start making comments, and they start bashing the Kennedy kids. And it's like, you know what, out of everything, Bobby Kennedy had, I think, what did he have, 10 or 12 kids? And they all, you know, grew up without their father, basically, because they were all young when he got shot.
Yeah.
And for people to make comments, like slamming the kids for what they're saying about it, I mean, to me, that's a special kind of ignorant. You know what I mean? That's just a special kind of ignorant. I just wanted to get that out of the way. Like, before you start making comments like that, and do some research. Do some research, you know?
Sure. And, I mean, I had a feeling. Now, it's kind of funny, because I have to scratch this off my list. Because that was something I was actually going to bring up to you in current topics. I had a little bit of current right. events here. Because I saw this, and, you know, the immediate reaction that I had was, I yelled out your name. I'm like, Sean. I'm like, because, I mean, how convenient is it that we've had podcast episodes right now? We're talking about this, RFK, JFK, MLK, you know, and I really did. I thought it was kind of coincidence that all of a sudden now, right here in this modern day time frame, that this is going down. It's a current event. It relates to exactly what we've been talking about in special episodes.
Right.
Special episodes that have been doing fantastic. But yeah, no, that was one of my, I was eventually going to ask you that if we didn't approach it later in the evening, I was going to ask if you saw that.
Yeah, no, I definitely seen it. And you know, like I said, it's just the comments just drive me crazy because, you know, people they get involved in stuff that they have no business talking about. Like, if you're going to make comments, you're going to at least do some research and at least, you know, but to be bashing the kids, that's what I don't understand. I mean, these, you know, RFK Jr. was young when his father was murdered. And,
sure.
and you know, you're going to start calling him all kind of names like that. That's a special kind of ignorant. But Facebook is loaded with them kind of people. And, you know, everywhere else is anywhere on social media. You're going to see ignorant creatures like that, you know.
I've come to learn that social media is not a platform for trusting. It's more of a platform for just it's electronic bashing. Because nobody, honestly, anything that I ever read to, Sean, I'm sorry to say it. I mean, if anybody here is a involved member of social media, I'm sorry to offend you by saying this. But I mean, really, I just think it's more so for you to flaunt and really just go out there and pride yourself in bashing something.
Just,
you know?
Well, a lot of these people, they just, you know, they just try to see how many likes they could get on Facebook, and they just make, you know, shocking comments and stuff. And it's just, it's tiresome, and it's just, you know, ridiculous.
Sure.
But I just wanted to address that. And then the other thing I wanted to say, you know, getting a lot of good feedback on the MLK episode, and people asking, you know, they have a lot of questions for Nate. Nate the Great did really great, good on that. And a lot of positive feedback on Nate. So I'm thinking next time we should probably put like all question episode together.
Yeah, that could work.
For next time you guys have me on, because I'm my questions are building up, and I just feel bad. I never get a chance to answer it in the back.
Yeah, because we keep just like, you know, throwing more information out into the
universe. Yeah, yeah, and the thing is, Mike Pilch asked a great question regarding the Sirhan thing, and I don't want to answer right now because my answer would be too long, and I don't want to cut it short. I want to give him, you know, full due on a question because it was a great question, and I'd rather answer it at a next episode,
yeah,
you know, instead of trying
totally
to.
Yeah, we'll bring you back for Q&A.
Maybe even Nate, too, because he's got some questions.
Yeah.
He's got about 3 or 4 directed at him already.
Yeah, of course. You tell him he's welcome back anytime.
Anytime.
All right, so want to get down and get in the Manson?
Let's do it.
Yep.
All right. Well, I mean, Jenna's the expert on the serial killers. My expertise is always, you know, CIA and this and that. And you know, I got involved in this because a book came out a couple years ago. I think it was 2019, 2020?
Yeah, 2019.
It was called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s. And it was by a guy by the name of Tom O'Neill. And he researched his book for 25 years. He did a lot of, you know, interviews and just, I mean, he dedicated his entire life to this book. And when I first heard about it, I was really skeptical about it because I'm thinking, you know, I mean, CIA, could they be involved in everything in the 60s? I mean, you know what I mean? It's just, I'm thinking Charles Manson, the thing is open and shut. I really didn't think much of it. Then I seen an interview with O'Neill on Joe Rogan, and he really, you know, he got my attention because all of a sudden the shadow of intelligence is all over the Manson case, you know, and all of a sudden I see where Manson had this get out of jail free card where, you know, so many things, he was just picked up and time again, he was let go and let go. And then all the people around him, so many people around him are tied to the intelligence community. And it's like Oswald all over again, you know what I mean? And it's like, I'm not trying to say Manson is innocent because he, you know, he's definitely, you know, I think he's a whack job, but and he should have been in prison. But I'm just saying, you know, was he a creation of the CIA? And that's the premise of the book by O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's called Chaos because it's based on Operation Chaos, which was a CIA's program to discredit the left. And that was basically the CIA's version of COINTELPRO, which was the FBI's program to discredit the left that we talked about on the last show with Martin Luther King. And the Chaos basically had the same targets, you know, that COINTELPRO did. And, you know, it was launched by Richard Helms, who we talked about a lot on this, Alan Dulles' guy that he mentored, and James Angleton, who we talked a lot about. And it was established under Johnson. It was expanded by Nixon. And it involved another guy we talked about a lot, which is Curtis LeMay, the Strategic Air Command, the Joint Chief of Staffs in the Air Force. He was heavily involved in that, even after he retired from the military and he got involved in defense contracts. He was heavily involved in this Chaos program. And you know, it was, you know, the targeting, it was kind of more aggressive than COINTELPRO. And the interesting thing is that the CIA is supposed to not be involved domestically. They're supposed to only be involved internationally. And Chaos targeted, they had files on over 7,000 Americans. And they had a computer index totaling like 300,000 civilians that they had in over like 1,000 left-wing groups. And some of the groups, you know, it's similar to COINTELPRO. You know, they had the anti-war movement, the Black Panthers, obviously, the hippie movement, which, you know, Manson was a part of, the Students for Democratic Society, the Young Lords, which is the Puerto Rican Civil Rights Group, Women's Liberation Movement, which I still want somebody to explain to me how Women's Right to Vote group is a national security threat, the Israeli Embassy, the Jewish Domestic Groups, I mean, Women's Strike for Peace, Ramparts Magazine, Black Civil Rights, Native American historical groups. And one of the big things they targeted was Hollywood's left wing. And that's where, you know, it's going to really tie into Manson because Manson was plugged into Hollywood. I'm sure you guys are familiar, you know, Manson and the Beach Boys. And
he was an
I mean, he was really
musician.
Plugged in. Yes,
that's
he was.
Actually,
he was.
Why he chose Polanski's house, actually.
Well, you know, there's a couple things on that. I'm gonna go a little deeper on that, Jen, of Polanski's house, because Polanski's house was became like a party central, and it became a central place
it
for
was.
A lot of Hollywood's left wing that was hanging out there, like Cass Elliot and Martin Sheen and Jane Fonda.
Oh, it was a cove.
And these guys, but these people that I just mentioned were all serious targets of not only COINTELPRO, but Operation Chaos, because Cass Elliot, Jane Fonda, who am I leaving out? Warren Beatty was a big one. They were very supportive of the Black Panthers. And they were all part of a group called the White Panthers, and they were under constant surveillance by the CIA and the FBI. And they felt that they were a definite national security threat because they were going after the Panthers. They declared war on the Black Panthers. There's no doubt about that. And since these guys were a fixture at that house, I think that's another reason why this could have been targeted. So Go ahead, well, Jen.
Before Polanski bought the house and they lived in it, there was a music producer that lived there. And Charles Manson tried to get a recording deal from that producer, and he was turned away. So, like, it didn't matter who was living in the house at the time. They just chose the house because that's where the record producer used to live.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yep.
So
do you want to set up the actual murders,
yeah,
Jen?
Yeah, sure. So
what happened that night?
Roman Polanski, the owner of the house, was married to Sharon Tate. And Polanski was actually out of town for that weekend. I think he was shooting a movie somewhere or whatever it was, but he wasn't there. So Polanski wasn't like the quote-unquote intended target, at least not to my knowledge. It was like just whoever was in the house was going to die. So Sharon Tate was at home, and it was just like her and a few of her friends. And before we got on, Sean was talking about, so like one of the members in the household was one of the Folger coffee heiresses.
Yeah, the heiress to the Folger. Yeah,
her name's Abigail. So it was Sharon, Abigail, I believe it was her hairdresser.
And just one thing on her, Jen, she was also part of this group, the White Panthers. She was also supportive of the Black Panthers, and she was close with a lot of the Hollywood left that was being targeted. And she was also targeted by Operation Chaos. Her name is in the files as well.
So, and it was also, like, the heiress, like, Abigail's, I think, like, her boyfriend was there. So it was the two of them, Sharon.
Yeah, was it her boyfriend from Poland?
Yeah, like, I...
Is that the guy that was from Poland?
I'm not
going
to try to pronounce his name because it's, like, it's crazy.
No.
It's, like, Frykowski, I think.
Something like that,
name.
Yeah.
And, like, I know that her hair, I think it was either, like, her hairdresser, her makeup artist, like, somebody. It was, like, one of her close friends. Mm-hmm. And, like, essentially, the followers, there was four of Manson's followers, and they were told to just, you know, kill everyone as gruesomely and horribly as you can. And Manson was not there that night. He was not present for these. He just sent his minions to do his bidding. And, like, when they broke into the main house, they had to pass, like, you know, like, it's a gated community. So, like, there's, like, a...
They killed the guy at the gate, right? The kid that was sitting,
like,
in the
car? Yeah, like, I don't want to say, like, it was, like, a little house or, like, a hut that you see now, but, like, there was, like, a security kid.
He was a security guard, wasn't he? Like, a security...
Mm-hmm, at the gate. So, first they killed him, and then, so then that's a total of five. Okay, so then it was, I think, like, her hairstylist, because they were friends, and then it was Tate, and then the heiress and her boyfriend. So, that was the five. Yeah, that's the five.
What was the date on that, Jen? Was it August 9th?
So the August...
okay,
because
that's going to be
August
important or something.
August 8th was the Sharon Tate... Yeah.
August 8th.
And then the La Bianca murders were August 9th.
Right.
That was the following evening. So... So essentially, once they got to the main house, like, everybody was, like, tortured with, like, ropes and, like, they were shot and stabbed. And it was just... a brutal scene.
Oh yeah.
And then
go ahead.
I was
gonna
say, like, and then they started, like, one of the key things to link the followers to the cases was they would write, no matter where they were, they would take the blood of the victims and they would start writing things on the walls. So
yeah,
then they wrote the word
pig
right?
on her door. Correct. So, at the time, though, the cops thought that this was, like, a drug deal going bad, probably because, Sean, you said it was a big, like, party house.
Right. Well, we're going to talk a lot about the police, though. We're going to get into a lot of the things on the police, but go ahead.
So, like, they also failed to connect, the following night, there were more people murdered, and the police, like, failed to connect them. So, like, if we, like, fast forward, like, you know, just, like, the short version, one of the followers was arrested, and he was bragging about it in prison, and that's the only reason why they were eventually, like, caught and tried is because some dude was bragging that, like, you know, he killed, or he, not he killed, he stabbed, like, one of the bodies, well, it like, was, over wasn't 50
it,
times.
I thought it was Susan Atkins that was doing that.
What?
That was bragging in prison. Wasn't
it's
it
one
her?
Of the followers, okay.
Yeah, I thought it was her, though. I don't think it was, I think it was...
Yeah, I think so. I just remember okay. It was one of them. I don't remember who exactly, but yeah. So just like an awful scene to see. And also Sharon Tate was like almost like to full term pregnancy too. So there's like an extra layer of horror added to that. So I don't know.
Well, that was good, Jen. That set it up, you know, perfect, you know, about what happened there. Now, this is where O'Neill takes over. He, you know, started investigating the case, and he thought, you know, there was nothing to it. Everything you said, that was it, and pretty open and shut case. And then he starts seeing all these things. And one of the things O'Neill does in the book is he absolutely destroys the prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi. And he makes a great case that Bugliosi should have been He should have been disbarred for what he did in this. And I'm not. And listen, I'm not trying to say that any of the people involved in the Manson family are innocent. That's not anything I'm trying to say. They're all guilty. There's no doubt about it. The guilt is, you know, it's just a matter of how did Charles Manson learn to do these mind control. You know what I mean? Like how that's where O'Neill ties him to the CIA's MK Ultra program, which we're going to talk about later. But with Bugliosi, I just want to, I don't want to go too deep into that. People could read the book on that, but you know, I've had a problem with Bugliosi for a long time. He's been a pro Warren Commission guy, and he wrote that awful book that's like 1500 pages, and he wrote it from his office. He never even left his office. How do you write a book on the Kennedy assassination? You never leave your office. You do it out for, you know what I mean? Like, how do you not go to Dallas? How do you not go to New Orleans? And, but anyway, the stuff that came out that, you know, he lied a lot. He had witnesses lying. He covered up a lot of stuff. He left stuff out. He the whole narrative that he had with Helter Skelter. I mean, there's just a lot, but the biggest thing on Bugliosi is that, he had, you heard you guys heard the old thing where, you know, the milkman, the son, you know, somebody's kid, hey, looks like the milkman's kid or whatever. Well, Bugliosi had an obsession with his milkman. Like, he said, he thought that the milkman was the father of his child. And the milkman was having an affair with his wife.
That's weird.
And Bugliosi absolutely harassed his family. To the point where he was picking up their kids from school and telling them all bad stuff about their parents, and he was harassing to the point where they had to go see a psychiatrist. He was stalking them, he was threatening them, and it's just amazing. And all this is going on. And then the other thing that came out about Bugliosi that O'Neill mentions in the book is that he had an affair himself, and he got his girlfriend pregnant, and then he beat the hell out of her, and He beat her to a pulp. He put her in the hospital. She didn't want to press charges, so he got away with it. But the thing is, you know, Bugliosi, and I remember Bugliosi because, Jen, you probably remember when the O.J. Simpson case was going on, my dad was so wrapped up into that. And he used to be on the Geraldo Rivera show. They used to cover the O.J. trial every night. And I just remember Bugliosi, he was just so outraged about the domestic violence with O.J., you know, and he was just, and I'm thinking, what a hypocrite. Here he is, you know. He's just as bad as O.J., right. You know what I mean? So anyway, I don't want to go too much into Bugliosi. Anybody could read about what a scumbag he is. You know, you read O'Neill's stuff, O'Neill did a great job on that. But getting back to the actual murder scene. So the months leading up to that, like I said, Polanski's house was like a fixture. It was like Hollywood's left wing. They were having all kind of crazy parties there. But there was a bunch of guys that were showing up there. Names were Billy Doyle, Pick Dawson, Tom Harrigan, and Charles Tackett, especially Tackett. All these guys had intelligence ties. And Tackett has a file. He's a 201 file. It ties him to a guy by the name of Hank Fine, who was a military intelligence officer who worked for the GR rifle program under William Harvey. And we talked about William Harvey. William Harvey was Dulles's guy that ran the assassination program for the CIA. And here's this guy, you know, that works for them, and he's all around Manson, all around the Polanski house the months leading up to this. And Hank Fine reported to General Curtis LeMay, and we're going to talk a lot about LeMay tonight. You know, he was heavily involved in the Operation Chaos. But it's just weird that all these guys were around the Polanski house with these intelligence ties, that, and this is what O'Neill covered, and this is when he first starts to see, geez, the CIA, you know, what are they doing here? And then all of a sudden, like, say a month before the murders, all these guys disappear.
Right.
It might even not been a month. It might have been like a couple weeks. They just, they're gone. You know what I mean? But they were around there the whole time, and then all of a sudden they're gone. Now, here's an interesting thing that O'Neill uncovered. Now, you said the murder was what, Jen? August 8th? Okay, so this is all declassified documents now. August 16th, right? So August 16th, the murders happened, but they still didn't catch anybody. There's still everybody, nobody knows who the murderer is. They're still on the loose. Well, August 16th at the Spahn Ranch, where Manson and the family were, the LAPD SWAT had a raid. Did you guys know about this?
I believe I read about this. Yeah.
Yeah, and the LA County Sheriff, their elite unit, they had the raid. They confiscated weapons. They arrested everybody at the scene. They said it was tied into an auto ring theft. But then they release everybody. And they arrested everybody, including Manson. Okay, and Manson, and they all got released, and Bugliosi later would say that the reason they released them was a misstated warrant, and that's why they had to release them. But O'Neill did a lot of great research, and he actually got a hold of the warrant, and the warrant wasn't misstated. So that was another Bugliosi lie. Right? So the other thing that came out about this is that the files, the Spahn Ranch was under constant surveillance by the LAPD and the LA County Sheriff's elite SWAT unit. They had that place under surveillance for months.
How did they get on the radar?
Before the actual murders.
Do you know?
How did they get on the radar is a good question, Jen. I don't have an answer for that. I don't have an answer. But the bigger question is, they had this under surveillance. How did they not know the murders were going to be happening? They had the place under...
Like, if you compare to Waco, like, do you remember what happened in Waco?
Sure.
FBI and the ATF, like, everybody was, like, staking out the Waco premises, too. So I was, you know, just like, oh, I wonder how they, you know, got on the radar. It was just like a, just throwing it out there.
Well, I don't know. But the thing is, the other question is, why were they released? If it wasn't for a misstated warrant, why did everybody get released? And you're going to see this is a pattern where Manson and the family, they were arrested, they were stopped, and Manson was on parole time and time again. He gets caught, and he should have been put back in prison. And it's interesting, and when Manson's in prison, it's always federal prisons. That's something I just want to throw out there, you know. But it seems to me like he was protected, and this is where O'Neill starts to think that he could have been part of this Operation Chaos, because when you think about it, you know, what did the Manson murders do? It really put the hippie movement, you know, as they're not love and peace, you know, good guys. The hippie movement, which was a target of Operation Chaos, now all of a sudden is associated with cults, is associated with murders. And also, remember, Manson also said that he was going to start a race war. Remember that? And a lot of it was with the Black Panthers. And that was a whole big thing of his with Helter Skelter. Do you remember that, Jen? And that was, in the Black Panthers was an absolute target of Operation Chaos.
Okay.
So anyway, he goes on, O'Neill goes on to interview a detective by the name of Gilroy, okay? And Gilroy was heavily involved in this case, and he started talking to O'Neill, and he developed a relationship over a while, because like I said, O'Neill was on his case for 25 years, and Gilroy told him that Manson got away with far too much at the Spahn Ranch months before the murders. And And even though he was a federal parolee, you know, he had no job. He had ready access to drugs, alcohol. He had underage girls. He had a cache of weapons. I mean, and the LAPD knew all right. about this. And the Malibu station at the LAP, Los Angeles Sheriff's Office, you know, they had him under surveillance constantly. And, you know, what Gilroy says is that they always looked the other way. And according to Gilroy, he said that the station got an order that came from somewhere else that said that it was handed down from on high, is how he described it. And he said that they were told, when it comes to Manson and the Spahn Ranch, make no arrests, take no police action towards Manson or any of his followers. And the question, it's crazy, Jen. Why? The question is why? You know, why? And who?
Why be so softening about it?
Well, the thing is,
you know,
who's above the, you know, the county sheriff's office and the LAPD that's giving them orders? And you know, this is where O'Neill starts tying it to the CIA, because, you know, we talked a lot about the police intelligence units and how they have the connection to the CIA. They're all part of the intelligence community.
Right.
And this is where O'Neill, you know, he really did a lot of research in interviewing people and tying them to this. And this whole thing is just like the whole raid on the ranch. I mean, none of it makes any sense. You know, and the fact that they had him under constant surveillance. You know, and I don't know. It's just, you know, and the thing is, at that raid, I mean, this was a massive raid. I mean, Jen, you watch it. We watch LAPD SWAT. Yeah. I mean, we know how these guys are. These guys are elite. They're an elite unit. It's cream of the crop. And they were all out, you know what I mean? There was full force, you know, raid on the ranch. And then all of a sudden he's let go. It's just, the whole thing is bizarre.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, that doesn't make sense.
And the other thing, well, it doesn't make sense, Jim, but think about this. Had they all been not released, they already would have been sitting in jail, yeah. right, when the cops finally realized that they were behind these murders.
How many people still mm-hmm. would have lived,
you know,
if they stayed in jail?
Exactly. So, you know, what the hell is going on? And then, you know, Brian, and we're going to talk about, you know, the way Manson, the charges, he just keeps getting away with, and they're letting him go. And O'Brien took this to a judge and a friend of his, and he had him look over all the stuff. And the guy was a retired judge, and he's looking at all the times Manson just got released or he got picked up and he should have been put back and he wasn't. And the judge just kept saying, this is chicken shit, this is chicken shit. And he said it over and over. He said, somebody is protecting this man. Somebody wants him on the street. It's like the judge said, I've seen this a million times with protected informants where they're committing crimes, they're doing this, and somebody is on high, is given the order to release him. You know? And then Manson or O'Neill took a lot of the information now that we're going to talk about in a little bit where He's tying him to the MK Ultra program, and he actually took it to an intelligence officer that he knows, and he told him, he said, do you think Charles Manson was an MK Ultra mind control experiment gone wrong? And the intelligence officer said no. He said, I think Charles Manson was an MK Ultra experiment gone right. Like, everything that happened was initiated. It was targeted to go after the people it was going after. It was, you know, targeted to make the hippie movement look bad, the Black Panthers. I mean, everything, the Hollywood's left, everything was you know, designed to win. It went just as it's designed to go, you know? And another name that came up is a guy by the name of Reeve Winston. I don't know if you guys ever heard of him.
No.
But he was all over this, too. And he was very close friend of Tate and Polanski's. But O'Neill did the research on him, and it turns out that Reeve Winston was a high-level CIA operative, okay? And he was undercover in the hippie movement, and what he was doing, he was tracking the Black Panthers. He started, because O'Neill went back and he interviewed his ex-wife. His ex-wife was from Sweden, and she said that when she first met Winston, he was acting like a communist, and she was turned off by that. And then he told her that he was undercover. He was just getting information on communists so he could give them to his handlers. and you know, he, like I said, he was with the CIA. And the interesting thing is he's tied to Curtis LeMay, obviously, and he's also tied to Sharon Tate's father, who was a military intelligence officer. Did you guys know that?
Never.
Colonel Tate? Yes. And after the murders, it looks like, you know, O'Neill found out that Tate was doing his own investigation, and it looks like this Reeve Winston was helping him. But O'Neill's theory is that Winston was keeping an eye on what Tate was actually finding out and then reporting it back to Curtis LeMay, because Winston was involved a long time before he was involved in this, and he was working for LeMay, and he just feels that he was actually tracking Colonel Tate to see what he knew about his investigation. But this guy Winston, like, it's just, and then the other interesting thing about Winston is the night of the murders, he called, I got to think about who, he called somebody and said that that Sharon Tate has been murdered. And he let them know, and this was like, nothing was released. So he obviously knew, you know, the information O'Neill has is that he might have been at the scene, or maybe like shortly after, that he knew, because I forget who he told, but whoever he told, they said the news didn't even break for hours. It was like 2 or 3 hours later where the news broke that the bodies were found.
Okay.
After Winston called him. So anyway, you know, the thing is, you got all these guys, all these intelligence guys are all around the Polanski house. They're around Manson. They're under surveillance. The unit, the SWAT team, they got them under surveillance. And again, O'Neill says that, you know, he ties this all to the Operation Chaos. Now, the other thing is that he ties it to the MK Ultra program. Okay? Now, there was a Haight-Ashbury clinic in San Francisco. Did you guys ever hear this? This is where Manson was. He went to San Francisco. Now, this, I want to say this is 67, 1967, 68. So Manson, when he goes in there, he's not the Charles Manson that we know, that Bugliosi said the bottom end of evil. You know what I mean? He's just, right. He's basically a guy that's a low-life criminal. Petty crimes, though. Nothing seriously violent. And he's got, you know, just a couple girls, the groupies following him around and stuff. But he doesn't have the family. He's not the control in the minds of these people, you know? And when he goes into this Haight-Ashbury clinic, he's going to be tied. There's going to be three people tied to this. And one of them is Roger Smith, who worked at that clinic. And Roger Smith was Manson's parole officer. And he was the guy that kept releasing Manson time and time again. He's releasing him. And how Roger Smith ties to this Haight-Ashbury clinic is he was working on a mental health study with prisoners, and he was working on this Haight-Ashbury clinic with that. Okay? And then another doctor that ties to Manson that worked at this Haight-Ashbury clinic was a guy by the name of David Smith, no relation to Roger Smith. Now, David Smith worked, he was working for projects that were getting funded by the CIA, and he was reporting to a guy at Haight-Ashbury clinic, another doctor by the name of Jolien Smith. Now, that name should be familiar, because Dr. Jolien Smith is the CIA doctor that went to see Jack Ruby in prison. Remember that, Matt? When he went to see Jack Ruby, and then whatever he did to Jack Ruby in prison, Ruby forgot everything. Like, he went into, he had a mental breakdown, and he was just spouting like nonsense. So the fact that Jolien West and David West and David Smith and then Roger Smith, they all have ties to the CIA. They're all working at this Haight-Ashbury clinic where Manson goes into, okay? So what O'Neill does is he does a lot of investigation on this. And what he did is he got, because Dr. West always, or Jolien West, he always denied involvement with the CIA, even though, you know, the evidence was overwhelming. But remember, Richard Helms destroyed all the MKUltra files, so you really couldn't prove it. So what O'Neill did is he found his papers, Jolien West's papers, that were, after he died, they were at UCLA. And what happened is O'Neill retrieved those papers. And in his papers, he went through all his files. He has the paperwork tying Julian West to Sidney Gottlieb, who was the head of the MKUltra program for the CIA. He was Alan Dulles' guy that he set up to run the program. And he has correspondence from West and Gottlieb going back 15, 20 years that they were. And the thing is that they were working on what they were trying to do is they were trying to get normal people. How do they get normal people to commit violent acts? You know, and how do they basically mind control people? You know, so basically what they were doing, you know, is exactly what Manson is accused of doing. Because a lot of the people in his family, you know, they didn't have like a lot of violence in their backgrounds, correct. Jen? So the question was always like, how did Charles Manson get these people to do what he got them to do? And here he is, he's tied to this Haight-Ashbury clinic where the MKUltra program run by Julian West is doing exactly what Manson, you know, was accused of doing. So it's just really interesting. I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah.
It's just amazing that, you know. And then the thing is, you know, we finally get the documentation that, you know, he's involved, that West is involved in the MKUltra program.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, just respectfully, like, I just completely disagree.
Okay, so you, but that's yeah. Fine. That's fine. Like, but so you don't find it. You don't find it.
I just find that it's a coincidence, at best. Yeah, because like if you look, so as like, you know, like somebody who has studied forensics and, you know, I know about profiling and things like that. Like Manson has textbook, like a messiah complex, and how you can get followers, like if you compare it to like the rise of Hitler, you know, like you find like broken people and you sound intelligent to these people and you start getting a following and then you start laying, you know, your I'd like to call them like crazier ideas on top of one another, and then you start asking for like, I don't want to say like a tribute, but you have to do things to prove your loyalty, and then to prove loyalty, these tasks kept getting bigger and greater and more crazy because Manson just had this idea of like ruling the world and he was going to burn the world along with him to get where he wanted to be.
Okay, but did he have those ideas before he went into this Haight-Ashbury
clinic?
Well,
that's the
Where's the documentation on that?
Well, if you look at his, like, he was a troubled youth his entire life.
Well, that's true, but there's a lot of troubled youths that don't go on to mind control people and the killing
which
people.
You don't have to, but if you have this, you know, like, world leadership idea, like, since you're a child and you just learn how to be impressionable to people and how to collect followers, like it's a very dangerous combination. So
I think what you're getting at is that, you know, I'm not trying to make it sound like I'm giving much props to Charles Manson here, but I mean, you're talking about a very charismatic guy.
It's dangerous. And, look at Hitler, you know, same way.
Right. Very charismatic. And you know what? The thing about him is that, you know, if you look at any of these books that say, you know, I'm dead serious. I was just looking this up before we even were putting this episode together because of doing my research. And, you know, I actually had here a reference of Hitler, too. You know, you may not like him and he may have been a very bad guy, but that does not omit the guy from being a top leader of his people. Right. Now, I mean, we're saying top leader because
the guy in charge.
His people fed into him. They believed him and followed him.
Whatever he asked. So, like, I don't believe mind control involved. Like, you have to remember the time period, too. There's a lot of drugs. There's a lot of sex. There's a lot of, you know, people.
Oh, he was so connected to the hippie scene.
He was. And one of the things was LSD, which is what MKUltra is all about. That's what they were working with was LSD.
Yep.
They were doing all kind of
acid dripped cigarettes and you name it, you know.
But again, it doesn't bother you that you know the CIA was doing the MKUltra program at this clinic that Manson went into.
No, because
That doesn't seem suspicious to you at all?
No, because he was in, like, where is that? San Francisco?
San Francisco.
No.
But again, this is before he's Charles Manson, that we know the epitome of evil. I mean, he's not, when he goes into that clinic, he's not the Charles Manson that he becomes when he leaves there.
He's still in jail. He was still in juvenile.
Yeah, but he's a petty criminal, Jen. He never had, and again.
We're talking small crime guy.
I get that.
Small crime guy. But why, then tell me why this Roger Smith, this federal parolee, time and time again let Manson go. There's over six occasions that he let him go.
Maybe Manson told him his idea of his life and what he wanted to do with his life, and maybe he just kind of felt for the guy and was like, here's your chance to go and make something of yourself. And instead,
but if you're saying that
batshit,
but if you're saying that he was this embodiment of evil right from the beginning, a guy with Roger Smith's background should have recognized that right from the beginning.
Yeah, but like
he shouldn't have let him go.
What happens is, like Matt said, like these very charismatic people, you're very good at hiding your personal ideas until you already have your following. Like, look at Hitler. It's like if you do like a mirror, like Hitler didn't start off with the Holocaust. He was a politician. He created his, I don't want to say a fan base, but he created his following, and it just snowballed from there because some of his political ideas made sense to a lot of people. Once he was in a position of power where he wanted to be, that's where he started laying down his personal crazy ideas like the Holocaust. So that's kind of what happens, is like you hide the terrible because you know it's terrible, but then, you know, you have to create your following. So you have to be logical. And these people are so smart that they know how to hide these things.
So it doesn't bother you at all that all these intelligence guys are all around. Like, what is Reed Winston doing there? Like, what is all these guys, what is, like, Charles Tackett and all these guys doing? Like, David Smith is Manson's doctor in San Francisco. He's reporting to Julian West, who's reporting to Sidney Gottlieb, who's running the MKUltra program.
Yeah, like, is there official documentation?
I mean, Reeve Winston
that
is reporting.
He was in it?
Yeah, that's what the. Yeah, well, that who's
Manson
in it?
Manson was in the program.
Yeah. Well, no, there isn't. O'Neill. Well, the thing is, Jen, again, Richard Helms destroyed all the MKUltra documents.
I get it. I just
We don't have the documents because he destroyed them.
I just think it's a coincidence.
So. Did you read the book, though?
Nor will I.
Well, I think O'Neill. Well, O'Neill's. I think he puts a pretty good case. Like, I think he puts a pretty good case that there's something going on here. There was something more going on, and it doesn't. A lot of the things just doesn't add up to me.
To put my two cents in to favor both sides here, you know, like I kind of look at it because Sean. I mean, it's a very believable story because I mean, the pieces are there. And I mean, a guy like that, I mean, if we're talking about somebody that's had such an inspiration and a leadership for these youths that would follow him, his family, I mean, you know, we don't know what his time frame was. We didn't know what his business was to the T. I mean, it very well could have been that he may have been part of an experimental group, maybe government controlled, maybe, you know, under the radar, totally something that we would never find out. Because honestly, you know, it's kind of funny that some of the readings that you find on Manson, there's a lot of reference that this guy was an experimental figure by, you know, an unknown group or something like that, or a shadow group. And I hate using that term because shadow group just kind of sounds like, what is it? What are we talking about? Cobra here or like, but like, I you really do have to wonder, like, you know, what actually got Manson to that point? Like, why was he so charismatic? Why was he so intelligent? Were people feeding things into him? And was that the reason that he became such a good manipulator to people?
Well, that's the thing. Like, I don't see, like, when I'm reading this book from O'Neill, and O'Neill did a lot of research on that, and he doesn't show Manson before he goes into San Francisco to the Haight-Ashbury Clinic. He's not this charismatic guy that we know. Uh-huh. That's what the problem is. Like, where did he learn to do this? And he just happens to go to a place where the CIA is doing exactly what he turns out to do.
But at the same token, I do see the coincidence side because, I mean, we're talking about a guy that, I mean, sorry for the time period. Like, I'm not trying to be stereotyped, but, I mean, it's heavily involved with drugs.
Yeah.
The music scene.
Well, sure it is.
He's a full-out hippie. I mean, his
but again, the whole
hippie.
MK Ultra program was revolving around drugs. I mean, one of the big things they were doing was experimenting with LSD, with mind control.
Yep.
I mean, and then here's another interesting thing that he had in the book, O'Neill. There was a trip that Manson was already on parole, and Roger Smith okays him to take a job down in Mexico to surveil soil. Now, let me ask you a question. Who the hell would hire Charles Manson to surveil soil
down in Mexico? Well, what year was this?
So, this, it was before the murders, obviously. I want to say 68, maybe.
Maybe he was just a guy.
He was on parole. You know? Well, here's the thing. O'Neill looked into the company that he was supposedly working for, and the company only existed for like 2 years. And then there was nothing else. He couldn't find anything else on him. And then it just kind of, it sounds like a shadow company.
Let me add one.
The CIA uses all the time.
Let me add one more thing here. And maybe this could kind of shed light on the, maybe your part that you're kind of talking about, Sean. And Jen, maybe this will kind of spark something. But, you know, if you'd ever think about it, like during these documentaries, like when they, you know, they talk to Tex, what was his name? Tex Watson, the girls, Patricia. I'm trying to think of the other
Susan
two.
Help Atkins. Me out.
Susan Atkins. Yep. Linda. Was it Linda something? Kasabian?
Kasabian.
Kasabian. Thank Kasabian. You. So, I mean, you're talking to people like this. And, I mean, the interviews are out there. I mean, you can watch them. They're in documentaries. They were talked to. They did answer questions, you know, obviously when they were in more of a mindset. But think about this. A lot of their testimony and a lot of their talks were always referenced that, you know, Charlie was never home. Charlie was doing this. Charlie was there. You know, like, why was it always that, where the fuck was, I'm sorry. Where was Charlie? Where was Charlie? Because why was it referenced so much that, listen, who did he have the ins and outs with? That he was away from a lot of his stuff. But once he came back home and he came to you, your family, boy, everything that he said, you had to go and you had to do. You had to do what Charlie did. You had to hear what Charlie heard.
Like, that's...
And I mean, I kind of find... But that's part of the manipulation process.
That behavior, yeah.
Well, right, cult. You know, like, I'm going to stay here. I'm waiting for you, Charlie, you know? I don't know. I just kind of find that interesting because I think some of those interviews, you go back to the Helter Skelter, the true story of the Manson murders. I mean, that right there talks about Vincent Bugliosi, right?
Yeah, but know? Again, if you read O'Neill's book, he kind of destroys Bugliosi. And you see a lot of the stuff he did. And I don't really want to go into detail. You could read the book and see. And,
yeah.
And you get a real bad impression of Bugliosi after you read the book.
Well, I think the documentary that I'm looking at, it was just called Manson. That was it. It was a dramatized documentary called Manson, you know?
I just have a lot of suspicion. Like, I know when I read this book, and like I said, I was skeptical first. But then when I realized that, you know... Operation Chaos was absolutely sent to target the left.
Sure.
I mean, they were absolutely. And then when I see Manson.
Hollywood, you know, people, was a good ground for that.
Hollywood. Well, that Hoover and Helms wanted to destroy Hollywood left. There's no doubt about that. They were so afraid that these guys like Warren Beatty and Cass Elliott and Jane Fonda, they were the anti-war movement, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two is they were very hardcore supporters of the Black Panthers, which they thought was a national security threat. So it's suspicious to me that Manson has all these ties to these guys that are tied to that. And then to the MKUltra program, I mean, I just find it highly suspicious that he... And then this Roger Smith, I mean, time and time again, he's letting them off. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I know what you're saying, Jen, about cults and stuff, but I'm just saying, and listen, I'm not trying to say Manson's innocent or anything else. I'm just saying, where did he learn
it? Yeah, because, like, to me, it's just like a coincidence, because, like, if you start, like, you know, to, you know, start a profile from, like, the baseline, like, you always start from essentially ground zero. So, like, his childhood, like, how was his childhood life?
Sure.
Were there any traumas?
Parents.
Yes, his parents. Like, she had Manson when she was 16 years old. So, like, he didn't have a good, like, family base. So, having a large family was always a dream of his. You know what I mean? Like, so there's just so many things that, like, when you put together a profile,
especially a
cult leader, anything like that, like, you always start at the baseline of childhood.
Okay, but what was the trigger, Jen? Because there was no violence in him until...
Well, I think that's the big
After 67 is when the violence... I mean, before San Francisco, is there any violence in Manson's background?
No.
That we know of, no.
So you don't find that suspicious? He goes into a clinic that's run by the CIA, basically? And then he comes out as the bottom end of evil, the most evil person ever to walk the planet, like Bugliosi said?
Yep.
Yeah.
You don't find that suspicious
no,
at all?
No, I don't.
Well, what was this triggered in?
That I don't know, because like what made him to the max? You know what I mean? Like that wasn't like my.
Yeah.
My
I don't know.
PhD.
I just
no, but you know what? That's the golden question. Sean, I'm with you over here too. Like, I mean, that's like me asking who killed Kennedy? Who shot Kennedy? You know, like,
listen, I can't say, you know, Manson. I can't be as you know direct on this as I am with. Alan Dulles ordered Kennedy to be hit. That I'm almost certain of. But I can't be certain that Manson, you know, was a CIA mind control MKUltra experiment. I'm just saying that I think there's a good case to be made here. But the problem is that it goes back to Richard Helms obstructing justice and destroying all the MKUltra files. So we don't know. We can't prove it. Like, Jen, you're asking me to have a document. Is there a document that says Manson was part of this? No. I don't have it because it's been destroyed.
Right.
You know? And then, but the thing is, once I hear the name Curtis LeMay, and I just get really suspicious because, again, this goes back to the same guy who said, you know, 20 million dead Americans is collateral damage. And here's the guy that was part of Operation Chaos. He was absolutely hell-bent on destroying the left. And here, you know, people that are around Manson are tied to him. They're working for him for the Operation Chaos program.
Sure.
And again, you know, LeMay was targeting people that were central figures at that house. So again, I don't know if I buy the motive that you said, Jen, was the reason they targeted that house. Could it have been a target because, you know, they were sending a message to Cass Elliott and the others that hung out at that house, Warren Beatty and all them.
Yeah.
Could that have been the reason why it was targeted?
Yeah, I don't know. Because, like, if you look at, again, like, his childhood, he didn't have a good childhood, and then being shunned by a music producer, that could have been a good switch. You know what I mean? So, because he was an aspiring musician.
Well, when was that the Beatles, like, when did he have that falling out with the, who
the
was
Beach
the
Boys?
Wilson, the Beach Boys, right?
That would
not
be Dennis,
Beatles,
that'd
sorry.
Be Dennis.
Dennis
Wilson.
Wilson, right?
Yep. Yeah, because everybody assumes that it was Brian, because Brian was kind of like the brains behind the Beach Boys, but no, this is Dennis Wilson, and you know, the funny thing about Dennis is that he was so house-opening to Manson and the family. There was actually a movie on this, I remember, and I mean, I'm not saying the movie was around the Beach Boys, but like, the part of the fact that they had somebody in there playing Dennis Wilson, I mean, this guy could have been in bed, but he'd let Manson and the family rule his roost, you know? And hey, yeah, you know, go out and drive my Rolls Royce. You know what? Go get it cleaned up. You know, enjoy yourself. Have drinks. Yeah, have a party. And why this guy just stayed right in bed and relaxed?
Well, Manson was plugged into Hollywood. There's no doubt about that. He was plugged into the Hollywood scene. And don't you think if you're sitting there, you're Curtis LeMay, don't you think Manson's a good choice to send him on the attack?
I just think
if you want to really get into reading that book, and when you read that book and you hear about the Haight-Ashbury Clinic in San Francisco, and then you see all these doctors tied to the MK Ultra program, I mean, to me, that's just really suspicious.
Yep.
It's just really suspicious.
Well, I think at this point, I think we should take a quick break. Jen, do you have anything else to add or...
Well, we're almost at the hour mark, aren't we?
We are at the hour mark.
I mean, I don't have that much more to really cover.
Okay.
Well, I mean, if you guys are completely fine with it, then I say we just keep gung-ho. Let's go.
I mean, we and Jen are just going to disagree here. Jen's going to, you know, and that's fine. That's fine. I mean, and Jen, I'm not completely sold. Believe me, I'm not. This isn't
like the word of God, I've been investigating this for
the Kennedy case. I've been on that. You know that. I've been on that since I was a kid. I mean, I've been, you know, this is just something I really just recently started to look into.
You're good.
You know, I just find it, like, the other thing that just bothers me that this Roger Smith time and time again let Manson off. You know, it just, it bothers me. Like, nobody's seen this coming. I mean, it just take it in the context of Oswald. Like, remember we talked about Oswald, how all these bells and whistles should have been going off before the Kennedy assassination, and the CIA dimmed the lights.
Yeah.
They dimmed the lights. Well, they kind of dimmed the lights on Manson before this, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, he's under constant surveillance at that ranch. I mean, how did nobody know what was going to happen? You're telling me they never talked about that? They never had that on tape? Right.
Yeah.
They had that under surveillance before the murders. And then why do the raid and then let him go? What was the purpose of that?
Yeah.
I mean, what was the purpose of that whole raid thing? That really bothers me.
Yep.
You know, and then the fact that Julian West, I mean, when you realize who he is and he's working for Sidney Gottlieb, who, you know, he's running the MK Ultra program. Right. And here Manson's at that clinic. I mean, that, I don't know. That's, to me, it's just really suspicious.
One quick thing I want to add in here, because Jenna, I heard that you were because, I mean, I'm trying to go back here to music trivia, you know, and the one thing about Manson was you're not wrong about him having a musical background. And one thing that, you know, I don't know what the whole story was. Did Wilson promise Manson, you know, an act? I know that Manson did music. He did parties. He would demo with his brother, Brian Wilson, and everything like that in the recording studios. But the relationship, I want to say, got sour. And I don't know if it got sour between Dennis or Brian. However, the outcome came down to this. It was Steven Desper, the audio engineer, not the record producer, the audio engineer. And he pretty much came out and called it and said, listen, Manson is not he's not a performing artist. We're not going to put him on a record. He has no experience in performing. That's it. Take it or leave it. And so, that really, I mean, it pissed Manson off, but it also, I want to say, you know, well, what was Dennis Wilson going to do? I mean, you got to listen at the end of the day. I mean, you're cutting the records for a company. You're working for that company. Do you want to make the money? Do you really care about this Manson guy? What's it going to be?
So you're trying to say, Jen, you think that was the trigger then?
Because
maybe he shut down.
Like, you know, like now if we're building a sandwich here, so like the bottom layer of the bread is not a good childhood. Then on top of not a good childhood, in and out of like juvenile hall, like whatever they called them back in the 60s. Then on top of that, he went to prison as a young man. So if you just start stacking the layers on top of layers on top of layers, then you add like the drugs and you know what I mean? Like, I just feel like eventually when you hear the word no, something's going to snap. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As you're building your sandwich here from the bottom up.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, where did he learn to control these people? I mean, he really,
it's not,
he didn't show any evidence of being able to do that before.
It's not really
though.
Controlling people. Like I said, like it's just gathering a following and then asking for like acts of loyalty. That's like,
But Jen, you're talking about taking somebody who's from a normal household and all of a sudden making them a mass murderer.
They all weren't.
I mean, that's more than
normal,
just
regular people. Like if you look at like, again, like textbook definition of a cult, it's typically like lonely people that are like broken and unwanted. Like, you know, like it's a special type of person that kind of falls into these cult traps.
But again, Manson showed no evidence of being a cult leader until he goes into this clinic, though. This is what I'm saying. Like, if you look at these guys, like you mentioned Waco, like David Koresh. I mean, these guys were like this for years.
Right.
Yep.
They were cult leaders for years. Manson showed no sign of that before he goes in this clinic in 67 or 68 or whatever. And then real quick, he becomes the cult leader, the master of evil.
I just think that, like, maybe he thought he had the answer to the world's problems, and that's when he decided that that's what he was going to do in life. Like, I just.
But again, this is what the MK Ultra program is trying to do. They're trying to create, you know, they're trying to mind control people into creating, into doing violent acts that normally they wouldn't commit. And, you know, this is exactly what he did.
You know, I just read something here, too, and I just want to enlighten you guys a little bit here real quick. So, Rolling Stone interview with several members of the Beach Boys revealed that Wilson's expenses from Manson included $1,200, now back in that day, just alone from Altadena Dairy Company, costing about $9,000 in today's currency. And then that was a lofty sum in penicillin treatments to quell an outbreak of gonorrhea among members of the family. Wilson also estimated that he spent about $100,000 on gifts just for the Manson family, covering clothes, kind assets, whatever the hell that is, kind assets, maybe gifts. But over the time, it eventually came to Dennis that he had to break the brief friendship up, and he also claimed that he has distanced himself because he claimed that Manson and his crew were parasitic. Then Jen, here you go. Now, parasitic, yes, we know what that is. But one thing I really like in here, and this is interesting too, returning to family's residence at Spahn Ranch without a record deal, Manson was even further vexed by the release of a Beach Boys song called Never Learn Not to Love, which was adapted from one of the Manson songs that he wrote with Dennis called Cease to Exist. So apparently that was reported that Manson signed over the rights to the writer. And he got royalty from that in exchange for a one-off cash payment and a motorcycle.
Let me ask you this. Why didn't he go after the Beach Boys then?
I don't know. But they just
Why didn't he target the Beach Boys?
He got a one-off cash payment and a motorcycle and said, I'll take that for the song.
See, like, to me, this is, as a profile, like, this is a good flick of the switch here. So, like, especially,
I was just going to say, that's kind
of, trying to solve you have the answer to the world's problems, and now you don't care if you burn everybody along the way with you. So, like, to me, this is a good flick
of the switch. I mean,
if
you wanted to be an aspiring musician that you wrote songs with Dennis and now the Beach Boys are releasing them, wouldn't you want to fight credit and have credit for your songs? I mean, I would as a musician. I mean, if
sure,
I wrote this,
but
yeah.
I mean, why didn't he go after them, though? Why didn't he target them? His anger is directed at them, why did he redirect it towards other people?
That's a good question.
And here's another question for you, Jen. Did any of the Manson family, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm asking you, did any of the Manson family prior to this have any violent acts in their background?
No, I don't think so.
That's troubling to me.
But see, here's the thing. Like, again, if we go back to, like, the Messiah figure, they make you feel safe and loved and wanted. And once you feel like that, you're going to do anything to keep that light shining on you. So once, like I said, he would start with, like, little acts of tribute, and then he worked his way all the way up to the murders.
Okay, but the thing is, people that could do that are very few and far between. I mean, you're talking, you know what I mean, that have the ability to control others like that. I mean, you're not talking about you're talking about a very small sample of people. So, I mean, I'm just saying, like, I don't see anything in Manson's background previously that he was able to do that.
That's just it, though. So, like, it's not controlling people. It's just you ask somebody to do something and they're desperate to do it for you. Do you know what I mean? Like when Matt said earlier before, like, he was very charismatic. So, like, he built a relationship with his followers.
But he wasn't before he went in that clinic, though. Yeah. I mean, I just don't see any evidence. Like, I don't see different. I just see a petty criminal.
There's a missing page here.
I don't know.
Like, when I look at him prior to this going into the clinic, I see a petty criminal that could just be anybody on the streets, any petty criminal. There's nothing to him that puts him on the radar like that. Oh, this guy's going to be the worst monster in history.
Yeah. I mean, you're comparing the guy that stole a pack of gum out of a grocery store to a murderer.
Right.
You know. Exactly that, and we did. We referenced that very well and appropriately because of the leadership the guy was. You know.
Like, Hitler didn't start out.
No,
insane,
I totally,
you know,
agree.
I mean? Like, you start small and then work your way to setting the world on fire.
But it makes me wonder a lot, though, because I get where Sean is coming from. There is a missing page here where we don't know all the information. And honestly, what happened in those times that he was going out to San Francisco at these clinics? We don't know what he was involved with. We don't even know who he was introduced to.
Well, one thing, you know, we know Alan Dulles backed Hitler, so I don't think it's a stretch to say Richard Helms backed Manson.
Well, there you go. And
I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying, Jen, like, I see what you're saying. I know what you, you know. I just see, like, I don't know. I just have a lot of problems with it. I see the shadow of intelligence all over this case.
See, like, to me, that's...
And it bothers me.
That is irrelevant. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can pick...
Why is it irrelevant, though? But they're involved in every big thing that happened in the 60s. The CIA is basically involved in. Why wouldn't they be involved
because
in this one?
When you start a profiler, when you start, like, you know, investigating somebody, you start from the foundation. So that's his bad childhood, his in and out of, like, you know, like I've said this multiple times already. So, like, in and out of the juvenile detention centers and then in prison. So, like, it's not a good, he suffered trauma. Like, he's not a 100% sane individual. He has trauma. So there is your basis of, now I want to burn the world. Just close the book there.
Yeah, not to, but I mean, that was said in documentaries, yeah. Of course, right? Interviews, like, they did claim that he had trauma growing up as a,
like,
child.
His mother was 16 years old when she had him. So, like, she was still a child herself. So there was no, like, loving relationship.
So there was no strong parenting there.
So, like, he was alone in the world and going through the system. You know what I mean? So, like, he never had a family.
Yeah.
He wanted a family. So that's all family trauma. So, like, right there, that's what lays the foundation. So, like, whatever else happens, as, like, you know, a forensic scientist looking at the case, it's irrelevant. These are the foundations where the evil takes root.
I don't know. I got to disagree. I don't think the CIA is ever irrelevant. Okay. Like, they're just all over. Like, they're just, I don't know. I just see the shadow. Like, they're all over. I can't say that it's irrelevant with all the stuff I know about, with the stuff they were doing and the way they were targeting, you know, the left in this country. I don't think I could call it irrelevant when I see all the suspicious things. And then, you know, that San Francisco clinic just really bothers me.
Yeah, I get that. It's just that, like,
I can't get past that clinic. I can't get past the fact that Manson's not Manson until he goes in a clinic where the CIA has doctors running MK Ultra, and then he comes out and he's the Manson that we know,
but
the monster.
But you also don't know that.
Like, what do you mean?
Externally vocal about it doesn't mean that those are the thoughts he wasn't having on the inside, which I don't know that either.
Well,
but, like,
I mean,
you can. You don't have to start spouting your crazy until you're ready.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I just find it very suspicious, though.
You can.
I just find it suspicious that, I mean, I don't think you could say it's irrelevant, though, that these MK Ultra doctors were at a place where Manson was. I mean, I don't know. It's just, I don't know.
I think this was very good talk. I mean, wow. I mean, there's some really good back and forth here tonight. I think a lot of people are going to be entertained with this.
Well, I mean,
but
I'm not 100% sold myself. I mean,
right.
I'm just suspicious.
Right.
I'm just suspicious. I'm not.
Which you're allowed.
I'm
to
not
be.
Sold.
You're
you know.
Totally allowed to be.
No, but you know what, though? I mean, my position was always on the fact that this guy, like I said, he's charismatic. He's a manipulator. He was just good at orchestrating things. And one thing that he orchestrated well was obviously the murders of these nine people. Is that what we're talking about? Nine people that died, including Sharon Tate, the individuals there in the house. Because it was a day after, right? There was another murder on August.
Yeah. And then there was the Hinman murder, too, right? Was that before? Wasn't the Gary Hinman? I think that was before the
probably.
Tate murder.
Because, like, usually
right
it's
before.
La Bianca and the Tate murders are, you know, lumped together because it was the 8th and the 9th.
And then the other thing, just as O'Neill puts a lot of stuff in where he ties Manson to other murders after that, where he thinks it could have happened.
Yep.
And he presents some evidence on that. But I don't know. I just think the book is really interesting. I think, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I think it was a good discussion tonight, but I'm still suspicious.
You know, I think this kind of goes forward, too. You know, this would be a good saying and a good time to tell people out there, listen, be careful who you choose as your friends.
Yeah.
You know? Because, I mean, talking about, like, I mean, we're talking about how Manson had involvement here, you know, and especially, I mean, we touched base on the whole thing with the Beach Boys and Dennis. You know, well, I mean, Dennis, yeah, you got to be careful there, buddy. And anybody, I mean, this is just a lesson in life that you got to be careful who you choose as your friends, you know? But, yeah.
So me and Jen could agree to disagree.
Totally fine.
It was a good discussion, though.
We have anything else to add?
Not really. I don't... I think it, you know, people should just check the book out, Chaos by Tom O'Neill, and see what you think. And
yep.
You know, I wish we could have had those files, but Richard Helms got rid of them. So.
And like I said, I want to recommend checking out that the dramatized documentary entitled Manson.
Yeah, and I'll say watch Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, that I'm telling you, that's good too.
It's a good movie.
I have to check that out. I haven't seen it.
It's worth the watch.
Right now, I think, if you have Stars.
That's Tarantino, right?
That's a Tarantino film.
That's one of his last. Like, I think Tarantino wants to do one more film and he's done, so.
Yeah, I heard that.
Wow.
So.
All right, Jen. Well, I think we're ready to wrap up, right?
Yeah, so, guys, if you stay tuned, we've got some, I guess because technically it's September 1st, Matt's got a bunch of Halloween nonsense lined up for you guys. You guys know my thoughts on fall activities by now.
Fall's upon us.
I'm sad, but listen, if it's not like 90 degrees out, like that's when we can do fall, Matt. When it's not 90.
Listen, you'll get your summer again. It'll be here before you know it.
It's still hanging in there, so we'll see what happens after Ida.
It is.
And so stick with us. We're gonna bring Sean back. Probably like I don't know. We'll have to work out on the schedule when exactly. Because we've got some other things in the works for you guys coming up. We'll also be announcing our lottery giveaway. So stay tuned. Yep. For that on social media and on the podcast. And thanks again for John coming and talking with us tonight. We appreciate it as always.
That was fun. It was a good discussion, Jed. I like when we go back
me too.
And forth.
It's really I get good. A little I get a little angry sometimes, so just don't
that's good.
Just don't mind me.
It's all right. I don't take it personally.
So all right guys, so we're gonna wrap up for the evening and we will check it back again with you guys next week. So everybody have a good week, stay safe, and you know, bail out your basements if you gotta. So good luck everybody, stay safe and have a good night. She thought I was okay, but he stepped off that train with a high and a piccolo and a cane.